It is 8:30 and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And look who's sitting across from us in the studios once again. Apparently they didn't learn their lesson last week. It's none other than John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State, amongst other things. And how are you both doing this morning?
I'm kind of stuffed up, but other than that, I'm fine. How are you?
And Maria?
I've lost my voice.
No, that,
I'm just kidding.
I am Maria.
I'm John, and I've lost my voice.
Just kidding.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, give me just a minute to put in a rerun tape.
There you go.
So
yeah, we're actually going to be talking about the same things this week we've talked about for the last 433 consecutive weeks. But yeah, go right ahead.
Yes, but we'll be putting a fresh glaze.
Yes, we change the details every week just to keep people off balance.
Mm-hmm.
So
because just to keep you listening.
Yeah, because if we don't, we know they'll drag us away and hold us without charges. But
they don't need that to drag you away and hold you without charges.
in fact, why does the door lock from the inside here? Right. I don't understand that.
Yeah, those are not postal employees outside waiting for you. So let's we got a lot to cover. So let's jump into it. We have. Famous, semi-famous person coming to the University of Washington campus today.
She's not staying in a downtown hotel, which is good, because I think she was afraid that the doorways will be blockaded or something.
As they would have been.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last time that happened, she called out the National Guard.
I know. That was, what, 2.5 years ago?
Yeah, and some people still remember her dearly for it. Madeleine Albright is back into town. She is receiving an honorary doctorate today from the University of Washington and giving words of wisdom to the UW's graduating, something like 10,000 students or something. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous. There's a much larger number than that of people who will actually be there. There's only a few problems with this. Number one, of course, is that the students have no say whatsoever in the choice of who is to be their commencement speaker and the words of wisdom that are given to them after four or however many years of struggle to get their degrees. It's given to them by the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents is also deciding to give the former Secretary of State and Ambassador to the United Nations only the second honorary doctorate the UW has given out in 81 years. I talked to the faculty person who chairs the committee that did the selection process, and he was saying that they're going to be doing more of it in the future. It's just that for many decades they fell out of the practice of doing it. So they did it for the first time a few months ago with Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and so they felt they needed to give equal time to somebody who would never win the Peace Prize, and that would be Madeleine Albright, who is probably most famous is the right word, but certainly notorious in much of the world, and especially the Middle East, for her infamous comment in 60 Minutes in 1996 when Leslie Stahl asks her point blank, the United Nations is reporting that 500,000 children have died in Iraq as a result of the economic sanctions that you have championed and helped enforce. Do you think that price is worth it to get Saddam Hussein? And she says point blank, yes, we think it's worth it. So here is not only who the left just sort of casually applies the term war criminal to, but somebody who basically has gone out and said, yes, I killed 500,000 people and I think it's worth it. And for that
500,000 children.
500,000 children. It's actually quite a few more people than that, yeah. So there's that. There's, of course, the infamous WTO incident. Just that, I'm Charlton. You can't feed me to the lions. I'm Charlton Heston. There's a bunch of other things from throughout the Clinton administration. Her championing of Suharto in Indonesia. She's been abysmal on Palestinian rights. Any number of different areas around the world in which she was a champion of very reactionary and rather bloody United States policy, the war in Yugoslavia and targeting of civilians. And for all of those high crimes, she's getting an honorary degree from UW, and a lot of people feel that's somehow inappropriate. I don't understand what their beef is, that, here they were studying and hitting the books and whatnot, and it took them many years, and she just went out and committed war crimes, and so, she can get her degree that way instead. It's sort of like a distance learning kind of a thing. So starting at noon, there will be people out leafleting and protesting in front of Husky Stadium. And hopefully that will be large, and at least some kind of messages can be sent both to and among graduating students that this is not something to aspire to when you make your way out into society, and also to the Board of Regents that, you know, when you're selecting future commencement speakers, you remember that big stink a couple of years ago when Evergreen had Mumia Abu-Jabal as a commencement speaker, and people screamed bloody murder because, well, he'd at least in theory, he was convicted of committing bloody murder. That was apparently a big brouhaha because Mumia had committed murder against only one person. What do you do with somebody who's committed a murder against at least 500,000 of them, and actually quite a few more? It's just not a good idea.
I think actually the picketing starts at 10:30 today, and then there's the rally itself is at 12.
Oh, okay. I was going off their press release. So that.
Oh well, you should know better than to ever believe press releases.
Yeah, that's true. But one way or another, it'll be out there. Just you know, follow the sirens, and that's where folks will be.
All right. So speaking of dirty bombs, that was at the beginning of the week was making a lot of coverage, and of course they were talking a bit about that on Counterspin this morning, but we wanted to get our 2 cents worth in.
The dirty bums, I think, was the media coverage because they were busy wiping the butts of the administration. But
it was, I don't know.
Maria and I think both have lots of things to say on this. You want to start in, Maria?
Sure, I will. There were two things about the arrest of Pedro Padilla, al-Muhajir's adopted.
Actually, but yeah.
Or Jose, sorry. Padilla al-Muhajir is his adopted Muslim name, that struck me as odd. One of the things is that there was mention that he had $10,000 cash in a suitcase, but there was no mention of what he was doing with $10,000 cash in a suitcase. We were supposed to believe that he was going to pay co-conspirators to get the plot going, or perhaps it was money he was going to live off of, or something.
He was going to take radioactive material and stuff it in his pockets and fly back.
He was going to pay $10,000 for a tiny, tiny speck of radioactive material or something. But there's a couple of large worldwide industries where people carry around huge sums of money in suitcases in cash, and Padilla could have been involved in either one or both of those. They had absolutely nothing to do with a dirty bomb, however. One of them, as you know, is the international black market arms trade. It's very possible Padilla might have been going to the streets of Chicago to buy weapons to send back to Pakistan. That's very possible. Another of those two large industries is the international drug trade, and it's very possible that Padilla was in Pakistan trying to establish a heroin connection.
Particularly since the government of Afghanistan, which we have put in place, which we'll talk about shortly, is ushering in the biggest opium crop in history, really.
Right, and Karzai has not poked his head out of Kabul to do anything about it, and is in fact supporting and consorting with warlords who are going to profit hugely off of the international heroin trade. So what shocks me is that when the media talked about Padilla's background as a Chicago gang member, they never mentioned the two things that gangs are well known for doing, the things that support them economically, and that's trading and transporting drugs, and trading and transporting black market weapons. So Padilla, I mean, if the U.S. government had any information that he was part of that, and they probably do, they could have arrested and tried him on those charges fairly easily, but they haven't. They're going for the dirty bomb thing as a way to kind of take the public's eye off of the investigation going on into the FBI and the CIA and what happened around 9/11, and to try to say, here we see how effective our intelligence agencies are. We're able to catch this guy before he could do anything. When in fact he was looking on the internet for information on how to, on how to build or what made up the components of a dirty bomb. I have to say, you know, I was doing that a couple months ago when they first started talking about what dirty bombs were. I was actually on the internet. I was looking at Washington Post website and the New York Times website and other news agencies that had diagrams of how dirty bombs could be made and so forth.
So when you get arrested, don't expect to be able to see a lawyer.
No, so I'm expecting to be arrested and put in indefinite detention anytime now.
Yeah, in fact, I think everybody listening, we should all get together down at the federal courthouse and turn ourselves in.
Me and several million people who have had an enormous curiosity about what the heck is a dirty bomb, you know.
And who weren't getting their questions answered in media.
That's true. We can all go down and turn ourselves in.
It's very funny. You know, people forget that a lot of these constitutional issues are being raised and justified because, quote unquote, we're at war. But we weren't at war. We were victims of a fairly heinous crime that got redefined as a war, talking about September 11th, as though the idea that a criminally inclined organization, talking about Al-Qaeda now, can operate across international boundaries and borders, and this is a brand new thing that the world has never confronted before. Well, gangs and drug cartels have been doing this sort of thing for many, many years, and it's much more likely that Padilla was involved in that kind of activity, but somehow, because we're now at war, that kind of activity goes right down the memory hole.
Or it becomes maybe he was competing with a CIA affiliate.
to establish a
heroin route.
Afghanistan's a very territorial kind of place, and that is what gangs fight over. But
if you really look for who established the heroin trade in that part of the world, you'd be led directly to the CIA and to military intelligence.
In many parts of the world over the last 50 or 60 years.
And I think it's possible that maybe folks in Pakistan and Afghanistan and want to get a better price for what they have to sell, and so they were trying to go around the CIA and was looking at somebody who was a Muslim to do the work for them, and Padilla might have been part of that.
There are many possibilities. The point is that the man is not being given the opportunity to defend himself, because he, as a United States citizen, just as easily as could happen to any of us or anybody who listening to this program, is being not only arrested and jailed, but he has been transferred out of the civilian court system into the military courts. And we heard our highest officials talking about, well, we're not going to charge him. We're going to imprison him indefinitely. We're not going to give him access to lawyers. He's never going to appear before a jury of his peers. I mean, what happened to the United States Constitution? It seems to have been abolished by executive fiat. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld made this very high-profile announcement on Monday from Moscow. I mean, he'd been holding the guy for a month, but been waiting for exactly the right symbolic moment so he'd go afterwards with the old CP bosses and talk about the establishment of a perfect totalitarian state. It's really very, very frightening what they've done. And I have to say, the Seattle Times and to a lesser extent the PI, but both of them really have been, and I'm not even going to talk about television news, they have been truly abysmal on this issue. There's been very little skepticism, which there's an enormous amount of. Once again, anytime you look at any kind of international, European or British media as to the guy's guilt, it's been more or less straight party line. United States, he said he did this. United States said he was going to do that, with almost no evidence that would hold up in a court of law. And then the whole thing about John Ashcroft, I think I might have said Rumsfeld earlier. It was Ashcroft.
I think you said Ashcroft.
Okay, they're both trotting.
You said Rumsfeld.
Yeah. they're both trotting the globe this week. Uh-huh. But, you know, John Ashcroft abolishing the Constitution essentially by executive fiat, that he made this announcement, and the fact that this guy is being held without charges and without trial took one sentence in the PI's front page story, buried about six paragraphs into a 30-paragraph story. They spent more time talking about Padilla's traffic violations in the 90s in Miami. It was really, really frightening that
that's not evidence. In most courts, prior convictions are not even allowed.
Well, and no, these weren't convictions. These were speeding tickets.
I know.
They're not like criminal acts or anything.
And there was ask the questions, what evidence does the government have?
Yeah. And
no
there was,
search for it, nothing.
There was only an effort to paint this guy as being so morally suspect. fact that why, of course, naturally he was interested in committing mass murder. You know, maybe the UW would give him an honorary doctorate and let him speak at commencement next year.
They could find him.
Yeah, that's true, if they can find him. The other thing is he just wasn't thinking big enough. Maybe that was his biggest crime. But
he didn't have a target yet.
Yeah,
lack of initiative.
It's really, though, very, very frightening, both things. Number one, that our government has decided that it's perfectly okay now, just as it has been for many months for non-citizens. We've got people here in King County who were arrested, who are non-citizens. I'm going in to interview one in the INS detention facility next week, working on a story for the Weekly that'll be out for hopefully the July 4th issue. A guy who was thrown into jail literally a couple days after 911 because he had a housemate who had some mental problems, was angry at him, and called up the FBI and said the guy was a Middle Eastern terrorist. Well, he's not, and the FBI decided he wasn't, but the INS decided to hold on to him, and he'll probably be in jail at least for another year until they get it all sorted out in the courts. This thing has been going on with non-citizens for months, and historically there has been no difference in how non-citizens or citizens are treated in terms of due process in the United States. So what a lot of folks have been saying all along was, you know, there's nothing to prevent things like many of the aspects of the Patriot Act, quote-unquote, or some of the other things that they've been doing from being applied not just to non-citizens but to anybody, regardless of their citizenship status. And we're seeing that now, where they apparently just intend to jail anybody for any reason they like and then get away with it. And then don't expect any help from the media being outraged about this, because they'll just take the press release and reprint it and stick a byline on it.
All right. Well, speaking of things that weren't getting much press this week, which obviously there's a lot of things that could fall on, but sticking along similar lines, Loya Jirga in Afghanistan.
The Loya Jirga was reported here, if they reported on it at all, as a great exercise in democracy in Afghanistan. For people who don't remember, because it wasn't reported in many places, the Loya Jirga is supposed to be the assembly of elected delegates from around Afghanistan coming together in Kabul in a large tent, because they don't have a large facility to meet in.
I believe it's a circus tent, actually.
Yeah, actually, it was used as
a beer hall. Beer tent.
It was used as a beer hall in Germany before they set it up in Kabul. But they were to come together, and they were supposed to vote on an interim president and other how to set up an interim government. And it wasn't exactly clear whether they were going to vote on who was going to be in the interim cabinet or whether the new interim president was going to do that. But the Loya Jirga, from the beginning, there were problems. There were people complaining that they were not able to vote for delegates. They would come to public meetings. They'd be shown up. They would show up and be sent home. People would go to the voting places and be turned away because they had not fought in the civil war. They had not participated in jihad, is how they put it, in the last 20 years. Some of the delegates themselves were beaten and jailed, especially in northern and western Afghanistan. Some were told not to show up at the Loya Jirga because the warlord had already decided who was going to be sitting in their place. Seats in the Loya Jirga were bought by several warlords who went to Kabul and bribed the Karzai administration to let them sit in and be part of the 500 that were supposed to be appointed by the Loya Jirga committee that set up the Loya Jirga. There were not supposed to be any weapons allowed in the assembly, and yet several members, at least one member of Karzai's government, the intelligence chief, marched into the assembly tent with his armed bodyguards in a show of intimidation. There's a clause in the agreement that sets up the Loya Jirga that said that anyone involved in killing civilians or involved in human rights abuses during the last 20 years would not be allowed to sit on the Loya Jirga, be part of the assembly, when in fact...
That should narrow it right down, but it doesn't.
Yeah, when in fact the delegates went in to sit down, the whole front row was made up of warlords who have committed human rights abuses and killed citizens. So, and that led to, on the first day, a period of absolute chaos. There were 500 more delegates who showed up than were supposed to be seated at the Loya Jirga. These 500 delegates were largely from refugee camps. They'd been elected by Afghani refugees. There are something like 4 million of them in Pakistan who had sent their delegates. But warlords had pretty much bump those people off of the Loya Jirga in order for them to sit and be part of the voting. And so they had to expand the number from 1,500 to something like 1,700, possibly 2,000 people. So it's not clear how many people are actually sitting on the council. So I can't see how they can even figure out what a majority is in that case. But the fighting over the speaker took up a whole day, and then at 6 a.m. the next morning, the Karzai candidate won when they had a very quick and very hasty vote, which I think is a little bit suspicious. But then there was the politicking over who would be running for president. There were two main candidates, actually three main candidates, but two who were competing. It was Hamid Karzai, the U.S.'s choice, who's been leading the government so far, and Zahir Shah, the former king. Zahir Shah actually had a very, very wide-ranging, very, very wide support among Pashtuns, Hazars, Uzbeks, people from Herat and Western Afghanistan, basically anybody who was not in the largely Tajiki-controlled government of Hamid Karzai. Were supporting Zahir Shah. He had over 800 delegates, which would have given him a majority. U.S. advisors of the Karzai government got to him and basically forced Zahir Shah to step down and to not run. And he made that announcement, which was a major shock to most of the delegates at the Loya Jirga. And then that wasn't enough. Burhanuddin Rabbani, who had been a president during the Civil War in the 80s, I believe in the late 80s, early 90s in Afghanistan, he was also drawing a lot of support, particularly after Zahir Shah stepped down. And what happened was the U.S. advisors of Karzai's government got to him as well and forced him to step down. And then there was one last candidate, a woman, Masuda Jalal, who has worked for the U.N.'s, I believe the U.N.'s World Food Program. She was going to run. Nobody thought she would win. But,
yeah, which the World Food Program, for folks who don't know, has been one of the main aid providers that helped hit off the famine this past fall.
But there could be no risk that anyone would draw a significant number of votes against Hamid Karzai. And so a member of Karzai's government went to Masuda Jalal and offered her a bribe to step down. And because she's a principled person, she said no. When the voting happened, she drew only about 170 votes, but... Hamid Karzai won. He basically was the only candidate that people knew. So they had one vote. It was for one candidate for one office. And largely aside from that, there has been very little of democracy going on in the Loya Jirga. And yet it's been reported here as a great exercise in democracy.
Yeah, the staggering thing about all of this is not that you have this small third world country where people are buying political office, because, you know, obviously Afghanistan's not the only country where that happens and where there are U.S. advisors overseeing the whole process. The amazing thing about this, and, you know, we'll go back to the specter of John Ashcroft making his announcement from Moscow, that during the old Soviet Union, you had people who literally sought out foreign news sources because they knew that they could not get objective reporting on things involving their own country from essentially the media at home. And that's very much the case with us in the United States right now. If people can remember that the very beginning of the bombing campaign, I hesitate to call it a war because we don't fight wars anymore. We just massacre from 40,000 feet and then send in a few Marines to clean up what's left. At the very beginning of that, there were all of these media profiles of the former king as the one person who could unite the war-torn, war-ravaged Afghanistan. Those profiles disappeared almost as soon as the United States government decided that it wanted to back Karzai, who has, is American-educated, has connections with U.S. intelligence services and oil companies and all kinds of fairly questionable things in his background. The U.S. has backed him, and the U.S. decided this is the guy who's going to run the country. And they're not taking no for an answer. And then it turns around and gets painted in our TV coverage and our newspapers, to the extent they've covered it at all, as this great joyous exercise in democracy. And, you know, you've got several hundred extra people who can't get in. Isn't this a sign that everybody yearns to be free and yearns to have democracy and participate? And isn't this wonderful? Well, no, it's not wonderful. It's a sign of corruption.
No, and in fact, the largest amount of applause that was drawn at the Loya Jirga was when a delegate, actually twice, two delegates got up. A man got up and said, there weren't supposed to be any people here with blood on their hands, but I see them everywhere. And he was talking about the warlords seated in the front row of the Loya Jirga. And he said, this looks more like a commander's council than it does like an exercise in democracy. And that drew a huge amount of applause from the people in the audience who know that the people who elected them do not like the warlords that Karzai is supporting and consorting with and using to control the rest of the country. Karzai is actually a weak leader. He has no influence outside Kabul, and so he has to cut deals with these bloody
warlords. It's a setup for civil war.
And it really is. It is a setup for civil war. Karzai's government is corrupt. It accepts bribes, and it makes bribes. He was not democratically elected when the U.S. appointed him as the interim president. He is not being democratically elected now, and it's setting up the country for more bloody combat when some of the people who supported Zahir Shah decide that the Loya Jirga was not a democratic process, and it isn't a democratic process, and they decide that they wanna take power or something.
All right, we only have a couple minutes left. Real briefly, if we can brush upon that, for those interested in smaller government, June 13th was a good day to pursue that. Were there trimming amendments?
Well, we certainly got the boot of restrictive arms control agreements off of our back. We're out of the ABM treaty now. Right? At the same very week that we're talking about the threat of nuclear proliferation in American cities, well, guess what? The Bush administration has taken a giant step down that road because it wants to build its big Star Wars projects. We've got the initial construction and peace camp and civil disobedience going on up the road in Fort Greeley and the Richardson Highway in Alaska this very weekend. You know, obviously setting it up as far away from the public eye and public spotlight as they can. Essentially, there are other geographic reasons as well, but the whole idea of doing this as far out of the public view is part of what's driving that, the idea of keeping the tests away from the public eye. A number of the Star Wars tests have taken place from southern Alaska, and that's where HAARP and some of the other systems are being put in. Very, very frightening stuff, bringing us much closer to the idea of accidental or intentional nuclear war, at the same time that we've got people in the Pentagon and the Bush administration saying we're going to invade Iraq and we're going to use nukes, which, you know, they're still debating. But even the fact that they're talking about it plausibly is very, very frightening.
Actually, I think they're past the debating point. They're now counting how many weapons they have and how many they have to make in order to do the invasion.
Yeah, that's one of the main things that has held up the invasion of Iraq, is that they don't have enough weapons because they dropped all the bombs
on
Afghanistan. Yeah, it's very true.
So, no, they're going
to
do it.
And look what democracy that brought to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
They are very much going to do it. And, you know, we had, obviously, the 20th anniversary of the big peace rallies in the early 80s, the million people in Central Park. There were another 50,000 up at the Peace Arch on the border. I was at that. And, you know, that whole movement was generated by 18 months of Ronald Reagan being in office. And you have to ask, after 18 months of George Bush, who is at least as dangerous, probably quite a bit more.
Actually.
Where's the response? Where's the resistance?
I don't know. Maybe people can phone in if they find it.
Put it on milk cartons or something. Yeah.
All right. We're really close to being done here, so I don't think we can squeeze anything else in.
We did want to talk briefly about Judy Berry and the FBI.
We did, right. If you can do it in 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I did want it to say very briefly. Tremendous award, $4.4 million against the Oakland Police Department and the FBI. That was a suit for false arrest. That was not a suit proving that the FBI bombed Judy Berry. Nobody still knows who did it. And the left is getting very careless about saying the FBI bombed Judy Berry. That's never been proven.
So, but clearly the FBI and
it was false arrest.
They still haven't found who bombed.
Yeah,
so.
But it could have been her ex-husband just as easily. I mean, we just don't know. And they've never really made a serious effort to investigate, which tells you something also.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
it was Madeleine Albright.
careful
with
there.
That, we are once again out of time, and thank goodness.
She likes bombing things, yes.
She does. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State. And tell us quickly where people can find Eat the State.
You can find it in bars, cafes, coffee shops,
until closing
bookstores, all over town. You can find us on the web at www.eattestate.org.
And do you have the phone number down
and
yet?
And I don't have the phone number down yet. It starts with a 9, though.
Yeah, it does. It's the voicemail is area code 206. 903-9461. That's for tips, feedbacks. If you're interested in volunteering, helping out, we can always use the help. Area code 206 or cheap one-liners, 903-9461.
All right. So we'll be talking with you both then next week.